We are approaching the closing stanza. In Ben Lee's 2-week stay in coronavirus hotel quarantine. So there are only a couple more opportunities for he and I, Max Quinn, hello, to get on the blower and chat it all out. And I still have questions. But as it turns out, so do you. Today, we address some listener feedback from the first bunch of episodes on QAnon, cults, and conspiracies, before we get stuck into trauma and therapy. Fun. We haven't even gotten into Ben's foray into cryptocurrency yet. Maybe that's tomorrow. But first, your questions. Right here, I'm Ben Lee in quarantine. Hello, Ben.
Hey, man. How are you?
You know, I'm really good. How are you?
Well, I'm good because we're on day 12 and we don't have COVID, apparently, and we are on the verge of getting out of here. So it's pretty exciting.
How's it feeling?
It feels really good. It's almost hard to believe. Like, we keep thinking something's going to go wrong. and it's crazy. Like, I was watching the Prime Minister on, like, the Today Show or something today. And just the reality that this is one of, like, two countries in the world that have free and safe travel throughout the country because there's zero COVID. It's kind of mind-blowing. I'm in such – I'm just wearing a lot of gratitude about it, you know?
Well, you know, it is something to be thankful for sure. Are you – how are you keeping up with what's going on overseas?
Yeah, well, obviously, like, I've been very invested in this, getting this administration out and welcoming the next one. And a big part of American politics is, like, you know, it can get a little bit complicated, but there's a very important regional election going on in Georgia on January, I think, 5th or 10th.
So these are the runoff elections, right?
Yeah, it's a runoff election for Georgia where there's two seats up for grabs. And basically it has the capacity to flip the Senate from being a Republican Senate to a Democratic Senate. And the reason that's important is that basically whatever ideas Biden has and his administration have and try and push through, the Senate have the ability to make that incredibly difficult if it's a Republican Senate. So that's when you hear people complaining about Mitch McConnell.
Right.
That's what he's basically his game, you know, has been for a long time. So the idea of being able to flip the Senate and get it Democratic is, you know, it's a really big deal, this election. So me and my friend Johanna put together an online festival called Save the Senate. And all of the money is going to something called Fair Fight, which is a woman called Stacey Abrams who combats voter suppression in Georgia. Because basically, if Black people were not disenfranchised and could vote easily, that would be a Democratic win for those Senate seats. So anyway, she has an amazing organization. But we've got this streaming festival. It's on it's on Friday night in the US, so I guess Saturday, you know, midday in Australia. And people can, it's $15. And check out this lineup. I'm not even going to say all of it. I'm just going to list the big ones. It's Amanda Palmer, Arnie DeFranco, Moses Sumney,
sick,
Jim James, Nico Case, Tom Morello, Rufus Wainwright.
Oh, my God.
Ockerville River, His Golden Messenger, Sarah Silverman, Margaret Cho, Alyssa Milano, Paul Scheer, Patton Oswalt, Jason Schwartzman, Whitmer Thomas, all doing little comedic bits. And so anyway, it's just like this amazing value and this huge endeavor we've put together, but it's going to throw some money towards trying to flip Georgia blue.
How do we get involved? Where can we go to buy tickets and all that kind of stuff?
There's links on all my socials, but it's basically through a platform called noonchorus.com, noonchorus.com, and that you can get tickets through that. But it's, it's going to be awesome.
I wanted to, along these lines, get to some listener feedback for this show, Ben, before we dive into blockchain and, you know, we can even see if we get there. But one of the things that people have been writing in and saying to me, which is 100% my bad as an interviewer, is, where can we go to stay up with this QAnon resistance as it's happening? Because to be honest with you, like, it's something that I've been struggling with a little bit as well. You know, it seems like for me to try and find
resources and to stay up to date, I kind of have to travel first to the source of the conspiracies, which in turn means that I'm diluting my own algorithm with more conspiratorial content. Yeah. People want to know where to go.
There's no real hub at the moment because it's all happening in real time. So there's probably 10 or 20 people on Twitter who are directly involved in trying to put this information together. Mm-hmm. And I count myself among them. I mean, honestly, I try and share things of value. In some ways, I don't know, I'm kind of aware that people who follow me, they're not necessarily super techie, and particularly sure. with like coding language and all of that. So I try and share sort of accessible things. There's an account run by an Australian guy that's really good. Let me just get the actual account name. It's river_adventures. And but adventures is spelt funny. It's river_adventures.
Cool.
And he wrote that piece that I sent you about we know QAnon is propaganda. Here's how it's come together. So he's written a few articles on Medium. He's really good. There's a bunch of people, but essentially, if people follow me, they'll be able to see what I retweet and stuff, and they'll be able to dig deeper from that perspective, probably.
That's a good place. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, cool. Yeah. We linked to some resources in episode 2 and 3 as well of the podcast. How quickly do you find, you say it's playing out in real time, how quickly are things changing in that world? Like, it might even be good for us to get a sense of what has changed in the narrative and in the way that it is being fought in the past week, and how, if that's something that you're across.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's two different issues, and we've sort of addressed this earlier on. There's the general population and their interaction with QAnon and QAnon concepts, and then there's the sort of structural stuff going on. I suppose the biggest changes that are happening, General Flynn is, I think, becoming more and more overt, and he's someone who has long been known to be loyal to QAnon, but what's been coming up more and more is exactly how far up in the organization he has a voice.
Yeah.
But he has been more and more overt about what he's going to be using his digital soldiers for. And there's a group of trolls that, you know, that article I sent you about the trolls who were really vocal around the Brett Kavanaugh case. Those trolls have kind of come back. So essentially have been kind of rehired. So you're starting to see a presence of a new type of troll than the kind of troll farms or organizations that were active around the election. And one of the things I'm kind of noticing is how the QAnon voices are very vocally starting to distance themselves from being Republicans. Because for a while they were like one and the same. And now that they know that the Republicans are not going to be in power, they're forced, maybe they're given the freedom to take up this almost third choice. They view themselves as anti-corruption vigilantes or something, but essentially truly a terrorist organization that operates outside of party lines.
In plain sight.
Yeah, so that's kind of one of the things I'm noticing. But I'm kind of continually just, for me, what brought me, my interest activated that initially was around this whole concept of New Age and the New Age movement and the kinds of things that are happening with Mickey Willis, who did Plandemic, and J.P. Sears, you know that comedian? Do you know that guy?
Oh, yeah, I do actually. Is he involved somehow?
He's gotten really involved. Actually, you know what? I'm neglecting one of my favorite resources that people can dig into. And this does begin particularly from the wellness space, but it's a great primer for understanding how all these arguments and sort of QAnon adjacent movements are happening is this a podcast called Conspirituality.
Great. I've listened to a few episodes.
Yeah. So, and it's fantastic. It's really, really good. And they talk a lot about what like Mickey Willis and J.P. Sears and how these voices, sort of almost like popular culture voices and social media influencers, are taking these, you know, anti-masking, anti-vax, COVID denialism, anti-cabal sort of theories into the mainstream in a sense. So that's a really good resource too. But yeah, I'm just kind of following information. Like one of the pieces of information that I tweeted out today, that's something I didn't realize until there's a kind of young kind of researcher guy called Arturo that I mentioned in a couple episodes ago. He's he did a live stream last night where he talked about the John Birch Society, which is something I'd heard the name mentioned of, like, you know, John Birch Paranoid Blues. I'd heard the name before, but I didn't quite know what it was. And it's kind of a paranoid anti-Illuminati group that goes back to, I think, the 50s. But what's very interesting about them was that the Koch brothers, or one of them at least, is a John Birch member. And, I mean, this sounds almost like QAnon. It sounds like conspiracy theory. But what's fascinating is I forget when it was. I shared the article today. I can speak. But basically what the John Birch Society said was that civil rights, the movement, as it was picking up steam in America in the 1960s, they accused it of basically being a Marxist disinformation narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that so this idea, here I found this article. The Anti-Defamation League shared it at a certain point. It's hang on, my internet's so slow here. 1965. John Birch members say the Reds are using the civil rights movement. And what's really interesting about it is this through line towards accusing BLM of being a George Soros-funded distraction. That was like a new idea to me when I heard that, when I was like, I can't believe the audacity of undermining civil rights by accusing it of being manipulated by essentially like white Illuminati. But I'm realizing this is a very old way of undermining civil rights. So
it feels like McCarthyism.
Yeah. It's connected. So for me, this isn't information that's new about what's happening with QAnon this week, but it's information about understanding the roots of this type of thinking.
Mm. And so you can look much back
like,
at the Church
yeah, much
Birch.
Like the Yeah, much like the adrenochrome thing echoes the blood libel, right?
Yeah.
So kind of generally with conspiracies, there's sort of nothing new under the sun.
Mm.
You know, you do tend to see them get recycled and repainted and dressed up in different ways. So for me, learning about the history of conspiracy thinking and the ways that it's been used as propaganda is very helpful in understanding what's going on with QAnon.
Because I imagine that it gives you a greater ability to then lend empathy in the spiritual world as well.
Yeah, and it also just makes you feel like I'm not insane. I knew there was something off about that.
Can you also explain the cicada thing? The other day you mentioned cicadas.
Yeah.
And from my understanding, it's like it's a puzzle that smart people use to recruit other smart people or something.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm not super techie, my understanding of it is also, you know, very superficial.
Yeah.
But essentially, it was like an online game,
right?
Where there were clues and problem solving techniques that were then used in the way in ARGs, in alternate reality gaming.
Your Pokemon
so
Go.
Basically the idea that you're like, you're in a mystery that you have to solve. It's like, you know, choose your own adventure. Remember those books?
Yeah.
It plays into that type of thing. But Cicada then, there's a lot of talk about that it was basically stolen. Like these puzzles would also get stolen. So people would then pose as ways to grift and make money, you know? Pose as the authors of puzzles they weren't and everything. But what's interesting about it is that it kind of went from simply problem solving into prophecy, which is actually like not that big a leap if you think about it. Because if you're trusting someone to take you on a journey, you're essentially trusting that they know the end of the journey.
Yeah.
That they can guide you through it, right?
Advanced analytics.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where you get into these really quite infuriating, in how far-fetched they are, ideas that you see floating around the QAnon universe. There's one theory that believes Q is essentially in the future and is using quantum computing and stuff to plant clues back on message boards that yes. will guide people to this idealized future
yes, after the storm. Feed this to me.
Yeah. So what you realize is once you're surrendering your own autonomy in the sense that you're following someone else's guide, you really do put your psyche in their hands. And it's not that big a leap from saying, see if you can see the correlation between this piece of geometry and this symphony, uh-huh. right? And saying something is going to happen on the 11th of the 11th, 2011. You know, whatever I mean, like using numerology right. and kind of like it's a world in which I think people's suspension of disbelief and their ability to play highly intelligent people kind of got hijacked for a different purpose. And the, you know, there's also another thing that's kind of interesting that listeners might want to look into if they're interested. There was a thing that Robert Anton Wilson created called Operation Mindfuck. And that was around the idea of can you mindfuck society through conspiracy theories? And I forget what year it happened in. I have a feeling it was in the 60s, but it was he sent letters into Playboy magazine and I think into some other newspapers, planting the seed that the Illuminati as a concept, which was not a very widely used conspiracy theory symbol at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
That basically there was this thing called the Illuminati behind many of these mysteries in society and politics going on. And when you look at, if you look up Operation Mindfuck, there's one or two articles about it. You realize it sort of like does set up as a precursor, like what QAnon could do. So basically between Operation Mindfuck, Cicada, general psyops that had been run, you know, by the CIA, it almost seems like QAnon was like a natural place to end up, where you bring the technology, the understanding of psychology and manipulation and cults and indoctrination and all that, and tie it all together basically on the internet. I feel like when the history books are finally written, it really is going to make sense that this horrifying phenomena was one we had to face in 2020.
Yeah, and like I'm sure that someone much smarter than me will be able to do the maths in the way that it makes precise sense as a linear equation.
Well, yeah, and then there'll be a whole conspiracy behind that, exactly.
Yeah. That's I also want to say Operation Mindfuck sounds like what Bam Margera would call his ska band.
It does sound like a band, doesn't it? Maybe we should do it. Maybe coming out of this podcast will be the band that we'll... Yeah. We'll start.
Yeah, that's great. That's exciting. okay, the last one that I've noticed people sending in with feedback and questions, multiple listeners getting in touch who say things like, oh, I was in a cult and left too, or... You know, I sent you one yesterday that was like, these experiences are so real to me and to hear it discussed openly is quite healing. Had you considered that as an outcome of this project? Because I had not, and it's very humbling.
I haven't thought of it specifically with these podcasts, but I've thought of it in terms of being open and being transparent. You know, it's funny when you think about a career in the arts and what are you going to have to offer? These aren't the kind of experiences that you plan on bringing into your body of work or what you represent, you know, but they are what happens. It's like ultimately, I think the biggest contribution you can make to culture is sharing about things that you've directly experienced, not that you're just posing and look cool, you know, singing about a certain thing. So I have considered that. By being transparent and challenging and confident in the way that a rock musician is allowed to be, right? Because if I was an academic or like a self-help author or something like that, it would all be, it would come with a tone of like, I don't know, and now I'm going to, and let me now run you through my book, The 10 Ways to Deprogram Yourself from Being in a Cult. You know, it would become sort of prescriptive and self-helpy and stuff. Whereas as a musician, I'm given the license to truly just speak for myself and to not worry about who I offend too much and to not have to be like the good boy or the good child or the polite messenger and just tell you what I've experienced. And I do, if nothing else, that has got to be liberating for people that don't feel they have that license.
When did you stop being a good boy, Ben?
I mean, I think it's something you battle forever. I mean, it's funny because like for me, praise and being a good boy is definitely my like Achilles heel. I want to be praised, baby, you know?
Oh dear. How common is it for you to be interacting with people who have been through these shared cult experiences? Because that was something that I was thinking about as I was reading these messages.
Well, I think it's more often than people realize because high control groups, which is what we're talking about, if people are interested in this subject, there's a guy called Stephen Hassan who's sort of he's the contemporary kind of cult expert, and he wrote a book called Combating Cult Mind Control, or something like that, or Combating Mind Control Groups. And he talks a lot about how high control groups or mind control groups, they can even be two-person groups. They can be me and my driving teacher. They can be a romantic relationship. They can be a parent. But these are basically about dynamics one gets into where they lose their sense of autonomy and they sort of secede that, whatever the word is, over to someone else in a position of authority. And I think once you start talking about this subject, not everybody has had a Hindu guru or a Peruvian shaman, but most people at some point of their life have found themselves involved in some type of a high control dynamic that made them very uncomfortable.
And I think that makes sense. And I don't know, when I tell people about the journey that I've been through with my mental health, even as someone who was great for a really long time and then was very much not very good, and now I'm pretty good again, the authenticity in the experience is not, you know, I had a terrible nightmare about the comedian Greg Fleet and then my brain broke, you know, but it is to say that like having been through that experience and talking about the feeling of it is where you find the commonality. Do you think that that's it?
I think absolutely. And there was an interesting, I did a little bit of reading about this guy, Stanislav Grof, who was an LSD researcher. And then when LSD became illegal, he moved into breath work and helping people create altered states through their breathing and then helping them interpret the work or whatever, the experience. But he said one thing that really stayed with me, which was he would find people who've suffered very deep trauma and he would help them trace it back. And what traditional, quote-unquote, therapists were often doing was stopping at the trauma that the person came in to complain about. Mm. And he said he would keep going back with it. So, for instance, a Holocaust survivor would be asked to not just understand their experience in the Holocaust, but understand where those feelings that came up in their experience had been encountered before or suggested before. And he got deep into some pretty out there stuff. Like he was really into in utero trauma to do with basically the split that happens due to the mother's fears and desires for the unborn baby. And he said one quote that I'll never forget, which was, long before man was ever in a concentration camp, there was a concentration camp inside man. And that blew me away because what he's saying is these experiences of trauma are archetypal. They're recreations. Like the thing that screwed me over was not the high control dynamic with a Hindu guru. It's what led me to that, which at the most profound level is the human's need belief that it can't survive on its own and needs an authority figure or a parent to dictate reality to it, you know? So So anyway, the reason I bring all this up is that, like, all of these traumas, if you keep tracing them back, they're human traumas. Like, I've never experienced any kind of sort of sexual assault or abuse, but I understand what I have been acted inappropriately towards, and I have experienced or been in the vicinity of, like, subtle degrees of sexual violence, and I can have compassion for it because it's like, you know, they say there but for the grace of God go I, but we really are all made of the same stuff. These traumas are, all of these traumas are completely relatable.
We're all, you know, molecules in human suits just getting around and bumping into stuff.
Yeah.
I've had the same, kind of a similar experience, I guess, today where I was walking down the street with my coffee and some blokes, real blokey blokes, you know, yelled out the car window and yelled some shit at me. And I was like, fuck, you know.
Wait, what about?
The way that I look, you know, like.
But what do you look? You look normal to me. What did they not like about you?
So I was wearing a yellow t-shirt tucked into a pair of like chinos. And I had a pair of loafers on. So I probably looked a bit
okay,
more...
so you looked like a little fashionable.
Yeah.
A little flamboyant.
A little flamboyant, a little like I thought about what I wanted to look like this morning.
Okay,
Ben.
Yeah. I get you. Cool.
That's a source of ire, I think, for some people, because it is like preying on or activating their inner homophobia, I think. And you know, but what I thought in that moment was shit, like, if this happens to me once in a blue moon, which it absolutely does, imagine how this feels for my friends who are in queer communities, who are women, who don't, do you know what I mean? Like, who have this experience to a much stronger degree, much more often. And I think that, as you were saying, this trauma, while I can't one-to-one replicate the experience, I have enough of it to go, okay, I hear you, you know? And I think that that's powerful in the way that we can communicate with each other. Reprocessing or reprocessing?
I mean, I don't know, not in any official capacity, but my memories are, they require constant processing because they're like, it's funny with memories because, you know, I've heard people say that you, each time you remember it differently. So by the time you have a memory that's like long held, it's actually extremely far away from what actually happened. But the emotional content of it is generally connected to what you felt in that time. Your story about it might change.
At the time, yeah.
And I find it continual. Like I've, for instance, with my career, there are certain moments I've had that I felt intense rejection or suffering or disdain towards me around. And I actually sort of appreciate those memories because there's something you can check back in with and go, where do I stand today in relation to that? Like, for instance, this is a very simple one. When I was 15 and Noise Addict put out our stuff through this label called Ouija in the UK, and they were like a punk sort of indie label, and they thought, because they were really into like bad reviews and stuff because they just thought it was hilarious.
Right.
So they sent me this file of bad reviews. And they meant it, I understand now, as almost like a celebration. But I was 15. Yeah. I mean, think about how insecure
you are.
And I opened this thing and I was just, I couldn't believe it. And they're like burned into my mind, you know, those kind of reviews. And I remember calling the label like concerned. And he was like, oh, yeah, we sent them because we thought they were really funny. And I appreciate that. In some ways, that was my initiation into having a thick skin. Dealing with a label that went, hey, this is how it is, man. Celebrate it. It's fun. You don't read the press. Yeah. Weigh it, you know. But that moment is one I can check back into over and over in my life and feel how far I've come or how far I haven't.
I think that resonates with me. I'll also say that I think that there are some memories, perhaps as you veer closer into the territory of trauma, that require probably an amount of processing. I've done a lot of work with EMDR, which is desensitization and reprocessing. And it was really, really helpful. And if I could, the process sounds insane, where you are basically trying to remember the traumatic event, the thing that you're scared of, the thing that happened to you, while you are following a moving wand with your eyes and listening to a constant beeping sound. So it's almost like your senses are everywhere. And I don't exactly know what the science is behind it, but in terms of the relief of distress, it helped me tremendously. And now I have that touchstone where I can look back at that moment and go, oh, that was no good, was it? You know?
I think a lot of those tools, I should read about the science behind that, but it reminds me of some of the basic tools of like Scientology or something that has the E-meter that's basically monitoring your stress when you talk about something. And it gets you to go into it enough times over enough sessions where you become non-reactive to that concept. And that's how you get things like Tom Cruise being able to look people in the eye with that like crazy kind of focus and shake hands and be like, you know, but sometimes I wonder, are those things actually resolving trauma, or are they kind of just like, are they doing what the bad reviews thing did to me? Are they building up your thick skin?
And galvanizing you.
Yeah, basically where they go, we're going to make you face this until you're too exhausted to keep running away from it.
I certainly can recall feeling absolutely beaten and exhausted by the sessions that I went through for EMDR. But I also know that now I feel like I've made my peace with a lot of things that I felt were not right inside of me. And that's great for me. You know, I feel great about it. And the other thing that helped was craniosacral therapy. My psychologist, Julie, like a big believer in that. And I think that's really cool, the way that like they stimulate the nerves in your head and your neck and help you to, I don't know, gain blood flow and simple stuff that helps in the relief of stress, which, you know, you and I have talked about as being a huge motivator for human suffering. I think that there's a lot of stuff there. Ben, let's call it for today and we'll come back tomorrow with...
I love we sort of have to have conceptual warning bells. So we like, we pick a subject to tackle in two episodes.
Yeah.
Away, I think generally. But we're also winding up. We're coming into our last few here, right?
Yeah, right. So how many days in quarantine have you got left?
Well, so essentially tomorrow we have the meeting with the police where you get the all clear and everything. And then the next day we leave. So it's essentially, after today it's two more.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll do two more and we'll maybe tomorrow we cover off blockchain and some questions I have about religion and collaboration. And then the last episode can be a summary of what we've learned, Ben.
Sounds good. I like it. Good syllabus.
Thank you, Ben.
All right, mate. Talk to you tomorrow.
Catch you later.
See ya.
Ben Lee in Quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben Lee. I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.